But first, Jenna Friedman. Jenna is a writer and comedian. Her credits include writing for The Late Show with David Letterman and an Academy Award nomination for her contributions to the screenplay for Borat 2, subsequent movie film.
Oh, nice.
Jenna has also worked as a field producer for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Now she's rolling all of that experience into her latest project, Indefensible, streaming on AMC+. In each episode, Jenna explores how dysfunctional our criminal justice system is. Jenna joins us from her LA home to chat about the series. One of the most fascinating things about Indefensible is how Jenna manages to weave funny moments into true stories about tragedy and injustice without missing a beat.
Well, I don't think I would have ever been able to sell a true crime show with comedic elements. That was all AMC, actually. They have been launching a true crime franchise, and I made fun of true crime on Conan, and they saw that set and reached out to me, and they were like, do you think we could make a true crime show that's like feminist and kind of funny? And I said, I don't know. And then the pandemic happened, and I was like, sure, anything's possible. And so in the beginning of the pandemic, we started to develop this show that kind of pulled from things I had done previously. And the first episode, with the one with like the Steven Steinberg who killed his wife in her sleep, that was the episode that we did first. We actually were able to track down this fellow named Dr. Martin Blinder, who was critical in the trial to convincing the jury that Alana drove her husband to kill her, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Dr. Blinder was still alive and willing to sit down with me, and I interviewed him, and that interview is for the most part what you saw in the show, and that's kind of what sold the series.
Mm-hmm. Each episode opens with,
sometimes the criminal justice system,
it was more like guilty until proven innocent,
isn't all that just.
That's a great tagline. How do you decide which cases to turn into episodes?
It's just a combination of, you know, who do we have access to? What is the larger meaning behind this case? My favorite cases are the ones that are about defenses that I think are outmoded, like the rough sex defense or the gay or trans panic defense, because I think there are, like, for example, with the gay panic defense, trans panic defense, 15 states now have already made it like an inadmissible defense.
Gay panic defense, what is it?
I kill a man and I said it's because he made an advance at me.
Is that a confession or a description of the gay panic defense?
It's a description of the gay panic defense.
Okay, so what are some factors that differentiate self-defense from a gay panic case where somebody would claim self-defense?
Often in a straight up traditional self-defense case, the person is shot or stabbed one or two times. What you see with gay panic cases or trans panic cases is that there is an extreme amount of force used. If you see somebody that is stabbed,
to me, it's like just about getting people aware that these are defenses used in courtrooms in 35 states. And if we actually thought about it and advocated against, you know, like for these people who die this way, then maybe we could actually like get rid of this defense.
How valuable has your experience working as a field producer on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart been to working on Indefensible?
I mean, completely valuable. I worked very closely with the editors. I was like in the raw footage, pulling out lines that I thought might work. I think that the type of thing that I do, whether it's like comedy or journalism or some kind of hybrid, is not intuitive. And having worked at The Daily Show and done that for a bunch of correspondents, and then the show that I did called Soft Focus after that, yeah, The Daily Show was like a crash course in film school for me. It really taught me so much.
Mm-hmm. Besides hosting the show and doing all of the interviews, you're also directing it. And we often hear about the difficulties that movie stars who direct themselves have. What's your directing experience been like?
I think for this project, it's just the tone was so hard to nail. So it was just all part of it. It didn't feel like I was doing anything outside of what I normally do to direct this, if that made sense. I had a really good team really great DPs on the different episodes, and you know, it's intuitive. I think it's just all part of it. It's not like, you know, well, they're like, okay, here's like one example. I didn't want to cry on camera, and with every family I talked to, I cried. And so early in shooting, I was like, anytime I cry, just like move the camera, because I just didn't even want that coverage. And then when I started to look at the raw footage, I was like, okay, I need to show emotion, because there is real emotion, and if we cut around it, then I look like an ice queen, you know? So I think not seeing how you look on camera is always a challenge if you're in something and you're directing it. You know, with this project, it was probably easier for me to direct than, you know, a scripted project.
Yeah. You mentioned crying, yeah, and trying to avoid being seen. I'm curious about how much of a psychic toll doing Indefensible has taken on you.
Well, thanks for asking that, because it is intense. And I was like Googling like secondhand trauma or secondary trauma, because it just like, I remember there was after the Tiffany Taylor interview, that was episode 5. I was in New York and I got robbed because I was like in open mode, and this homeless woman came up to me, and I just like, it's a longer story, but I just didn't have my defenses up because I had spent the prior day just totally in open mode with Tiffany. It was a good lesson in like, you know, you got to leave your work at work.
I love the way that you're able to find ways to inject your dark sense of Friedman-esque humor into the show. How difficult is it to do that, considering that you're dealing with these tragic true stories of grief and loss?
It's really hard. I think also, and I feel lucky that I'm so under the radar and like nobody knows who I am, because for one, I just love anonymity. But then on the downside is like when we would go into do a Daily Show piece on a dark subject, there would be trust there. People knew John. They knew his point of view. They trusted him. Whereas with this project, it's like they don't know who I am, for better or for worse. With the defense attorneys, it was great because I could, you know, disarm them. But with the families, it's crazy that they trusted me after, especially, you know, episode 2. Ashley Andrade, the granddaughter of Francisca Martinez, that whole family had been through so much on every level. The matriarch of the family was not only murdered, but like shamed in her death so viciously. And so for Ashley to trust me to be able to honor her and tell her story without having like seen me do that, I was really blown away by that. And I heard from her that she was really happy about how the episode came out. And those were the moments that I just really hang on to, because it was such a hard process. But things like that just kind of make it worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. You occasionally break the fourth wall on the show to create some marvelously meta and very smart moments. Can you tell us a bit about why you use that approach? Let's be more specific. I should have phrased it more specifically. The beginning of episode 5, The Perfect Victim.
She was the all-American girl next door. Prom queen, homecoming queen, captain of her high school cheerleading squad. She was blonde, white, just a small town blonde white girl with her whole life ahead of her. Do I have your attention? Good, because forget what I just said. I was just trying to keep you engaged, because market research tells me what you want. And it's white chicks murdered 24/7. The truth is, the women at the center of our story might not fit your typical true crime show victim profile, which is all the more reason to keep watching.
I mean, that episode was such a minefield because it was so harsh. You know, some of the women, we didn't have footage to tell their stories. We didn't have archival images of them, and we didn't really know, you know, we just didn't have access to it. So it's like, sometimes you feel like you're trespassing into other people's stories to talk about this, but we did have access to Tiffany, this woman who survived this attack. And I wasn't very nervous about that. And then I just kind of like, why am I nervous? Okay. Because true crime has a history of like being told by white people about white people. And if I just approach my nervousness head on, like I do with a lot of my comedy, and kind of talk about that, then maybe it'll work.
Yeah, and you pull that off very well. That's what I think kind of is the USP, the unique selling proposition of your show, is that the way you found to kind of blend comedy with true crime, with, you know, with still being funny and also still paying respect to the victims of these crimes. In the final episode, you sit down to talk to the well-known women's rights attorney, Gloria Allred. Can you tell us about this interview?
Gloria. So it was crazy to find out that Gloria was even involved in the case. But then you're like, she's involved in every high profile case in Los Angeles. So I think we even have that line in there. I was very nervous. I had fangirled out on Gloria. I watched her documentary the night before. And then I also was in the chair kind of doing the thing I do. And she did not like that.
Yeah.
At one point we cut it from the piece because it was just a little... It felt a little too mean, but she was talking really slowly and it was intentional. And I just kind of was like, are you speaking so slowly because you're being paid by the hour? And she like hated that.
Yeah.
And I don't think she got what I was doing.
Do you have hope for the future of the criminal justice system being a little bit more equitable than it is now?
With all due respect, hope is a child's word. And I don't invest my time in hoping. Because we have to work for change. Hoping never gives us anything.
I feel the same way, Mom. Sorry, Gloria.
Actually, many of my clients call me Mama Gloria.
I feel like she's someone who should get it because she spent her history like kind of going about shedding light on really important things, but doing it through unorthodox means, which is what I do. I also think, you know, it's tricky because when you are dealing with like death, and murder, it's really hard to like throw that needle. But yeah, that was an interesting interview. And I do not think that she walked away from it happy, to be totally honest.
Do you feel that making indefensible can help make the criminal justice system more just?
I have no idea. Do I think that media plays a role in shifting public consciousness? Absolutely. I always look at like LGBTQ rights and how that has shifted in such a positive direction from like Ellen and Will and Grace, you know, but this is a tiny show and a streamer no one has. But do I think that entertainment can bring people together? Absolutely. Can raise awareness for sure. Do I think that the projects that I keep doing on tiny platforms nobody has do anything? No.
Not yet, but you're going to move on to bigger platforms. Is there going to be a second season?
We're in talks about that now. There are stories that I want to tell. The network has been very, very supportive. I don't think the show, it was tricky. And that I got very little resistance from them to their credit, which is really cool. And so, yeah, there might be another season.
Okay. I could easily see you doing a late night talk show like Late Night with Jenna Friedman, but I think you would probably get bored doing that. So I'm curious, what is next for you? You mentioned a scripted feature you're working on. Can you tell us anything about it?
Sure. Yeah. There's a feature that I have been trying to get made forever. I feel like we're closer than we've ever been, and it would be amazing if we were able to make that. I have a couple projects in television. I'm doing another stand-up special. I'm like working on that now. And I sold a book during the pandemic that I'm like writing. It's just a series of essays. It'll be called Not Funny. I haven't told anyone about it yet except for you. So.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Jenna Friedman, thank you for joining us again. Congratulations on True Crime Story Indefensible. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much for having me and stay safe out there.
Jenna Friedman is the host of True Crime Story Indefensible, which airs on Sundance TV and streams on AMC Plus. You can find out more about Jenna and Indefensible at WPR.org/beta.
So I find that Social Network is where this newish phase of Fincher that definitely carries through in Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl, where you have him locating clarity and speed.
Coming up, film critic Adam Naiman joins us to discuss one of the masters of contemporary film, David Fincher. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.